I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today. Oh yes, it's Levy, and I've got some exciting, exciting news for you. 750 is now available in several more states. That's right, the amazingly powerful and easy-to-use 750 service and search tools are now available for wholesale buyers to use in Illinois, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina. That's in addition to all the states it's already been successful in: New York, New Jersey, California, Colorado, Connecticut, and Delaware. The 750 service is an amazingly powerful, simple to use, fundamental part of making your life as a wholesale buyer easier every day. Check it out, 750.com, for more information. That's 750.com. If you're a wholesale buyer in Boston, Chicago, D.C., anywhere in Virginia, check it out. 750 is there for you, ready to use. It's exciting. Get on it. Jan Peterson of Bodega Ray Fernanda de Castilla on the show today. Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Very nice
to
have you.
Great to be in New York.
You are the head and owner of a sherry producer, a bodega in Jerez.
Yes. Well, I'm since 1999, I took over the sherry company Bodega Rey Fernando de Castilla in Jerez. It's a small producer that has always been concentrating on the very high end of sherry and brandy. And, well, the company goes back, well, really several centuries, because the family that started it is one of the greatest grape-growing families in the sherry district. They've been involved with the sherry industry since, well, the end of the 17th century. And for many generations, they've been supplying grapes to the sherry industry. And then in the 1960s, they saw that, you know, basically all the money, you know, was made by the people that actually branded the sherries. And they thought, well, let's try and create a brand for, you know, the better part of our production. And also they had a big idea, which was to sell sherry to the Spanish market. Because at the time, you know, the sherry market developed in two different directions. The export types of sherry were sort of increasingly the semi-sweet, the semi-dry, the mediums, the goldens, the pale creams, and prices were going down, volumes were going up, and this tendency never hit Spain. You know, the Spanish market was always, well, in Spain, people call sherry vino de Jerez, and it's a wine. It's a wine that you enjoy with food. And the Spanish market was always demanding, you know, the original, traditional styles of wines that are either very dry or very sweet. And the Spanish never understood the blended semi-sweet sherries. And a lot of the brands that are famous in Northern Europe, in North America, are simply not on the market in Spain and not consumed by the Spanish public. So Fernando saw an opportunity to create products, you know, both in the brandy sector and in the sherry sector, that was more aimed at people that still wanted to enjoy very good sherry with their tapas food and with the things. And it really is continuing to use sherry as it was always done. If you go back a few generations over here in the United States, Northern Europe, people were drinking sherry with starters, with soups. It belonged in a dining context, and not something consumed mid-afternoon and when somebody came around the house. You know, it never took off in Spain.
So how did you get there? Because you weren't born in Spain.
No, I was not. I'm Norwegian. And as you know, a lot of people before me in the sherry trade, you know, I came to Spain, you know, initially to study at the university in Barcelona. I finished my studies there, and I was hired by one of the largest companies in the business, actually the largest company in the business at the time, Osborne. And I joined them for the international division back in 1983. And I planned to stay with them for a few years and then maybe, you know, do something else. But, you know, it was very exciting times. You know, there was a lot of interesting project with Osborne. And one day I woke up and I had spent 16 years with Osborne. And I also saw that this company, a fabulous company, but, you know, when I joined, for us, sherry and brandy and port, the traditional products, were given less priority, and they were moving into a lot of other areas. And I was, of course, part of that as well. But I started to sense that there were opportunities that we were not capitalizing on. And one day I was approached by Fernando, and he was reaching retirement age, and he wanted a partner and somebody to join him, so we run the company while he could sort of more or less retire. And I wasn't interested in sort of joining him and building or taking this company to a new level, being a minority partner. So together with family and two friends, we actually ended up buying 100% of the company. So this was, you know, late 1999, early 2000. And I set about doing what I thought was necessary to do with the great brand of sherry and brandy. And I assessed what we had. We had to hire new people. I hired a new winemaker. I hired a new commercial manager for Spain that came from, you know, González Vías, another bigger operator. I hired a new export manager that came with me from Osborne. We sort of restored the facilities. We also ended up buying another small sherry house called José Bustamante, which was located conveniently just across the road from Fernando de Castilla. So we managed to get, well, more or less double in size, in sort of space. And it's a very, very beautiful setting. I really think our cellars are among the most beautiful in the whole sherry region. And we started to present our products, you know, some from 2001 onwards, opening new markets. And we had a clear idea that, you know, first of all, we wanted to retain Spain as our main focus. And, you know, we wanted to develop our presence in Spain and not lose that position. You know, on the contrary, I think strong brands, they need to have a strong base where they come from. If not, it's difficult. You know, people find out these days. We live in a fishbowl, and if you sell a brand of sherry that nobody wants to drink in Jerez, you know, it's like difficult. And in the UK, we focused a lot on the UK. You know, for us, the UK is, you know, the other home of sherry. You know, most sherry companies in the past, they would have an office, well, sellers in Jerez and a sales office in London. And then from London, it would be spread out to the corners of the world. And today, the UK is our biggest market. And the last 2 years, we've started to focus on the US as well. So we're almost getting there.
But no national importer for you?
No, we talked to people, and it's strange, you know, a few years ago, because I had good contacts in the business from my other company, we talked to a number of the sort of larger national distributors, and they didn't want to talk to us much. And so we said, well, okay, we'll do it the other way. We'll talk to, you know, we'll go to the markets where we want to be, which, you know, for us would be New York and New Jersey and, you know, Boston, Washington, Chicago, I would say Denver as well, and obviously California, where there is interest in wine, and we'll sell directly to importers in those states. And I think for the consumers of our products, it's a good thing, because they will be able to purchase the products at a lower price, since it goes straight from our sellers to an importer in each individual state. And, you know, for the time being, at least, there's areas in the United States where it's a little bit too early for our style of sherry, which is, you know, it's not the easiest. We make very good products, but you need a certain sort of background and understanding of this type of sherry before you can start to enjoy it.
So let's talk a little bit about the sherries that you do make. You have two ranges of sherry.
Yes, you know, we early on, we had it very clear, you know, I'd say the sherry market will be sort of grouped into four sort of quality levels. One is sort of the entry level sherry, which is where a lot of the sort of medium and goldens and semi-sweet, semi-dry wines and a lot of own label sherries, and especially in Northern Europe. And this is an area where we cannot compete and where we didn't want to be. And then you have the sort of the premium area and the upper end. And then you have the extremely expensive ones. We don't do those either. We don't have sherries in the sort of 200 euro a bottle price range. But we have one range at the premium level, which is our classic range, very fine wines, very true to the tradition of Jerez. And you know what you get when you get to know these wines? It's the type of manzanilla that people expect. A very fresh, fragrant, crisp, delicious young manzanilla to go with fish and seafood and tapas food. And same thing with the classic fino. It's one of those finos which are you can really use like a white wine. You can two or three people can enjoy one bottle in a meal and using it as a wine. The same thing with the rest of the classic ranges: an Amontillado, a dry Amontillado, a dry Oloroso, there's a Pedro Jimenez. So we can sort of at, I'd say, retail sort of $20 a bottle. We have very fine sherries, and then we have the range that has put us on the map when it comes to good sherries, which is the Antique range, which are five wines that we have aimed to sort of create the ultimate sherries in each and one of those categories. And there's the Antique Fino, which is a Fino, which is aged for 8 to 9 years, which is unusually long. And it's also drawn from the casks in its raw and natural state. And we don't do any industrial processes with wine. When it leaves the cask, there's no cold stabilization, there's no fining, there's no clarification, there's no blending, there's no sweetening, there's nothing done to it. The only thing we do is with a paper filter, we take away any sort of larger solids, and we re-fortify the wine from 15.2%, which is the strength in the solera. We bring it up to 17%. To avoid any sort of unwanted microbiological activity in the wine, and bottle it, and it's worked out well. It's sort of created, I think, an interest in real fino and finos that are sort of aged further than normal, with more flavor, with more depth, with more complexity, and wines that are incredibly interesting. And I started this basically because I personally love those sherries. And I have friends in the trade and restaurants and a few customers that are also interested in this. And what's happened in the last years is that the demand for this type of sherry is increasing. And we see a lot of companies now also coming out with wines like this. And also this, what we call enrama, or natural finos.
You're known for dosing the fino with a bit more alcohol than others might do. And why would you do that? And what does that mean?
Well, the thing is, I'm old enough to remember that, in the old days, if you were shipping manzanillas or finos around, they would very quickly go bad. I remember, when I joined Osborne in 1983, people were saying that manzanilla would go bad on the road from Sanlúcar to Seville, which is 50 miles away. So, they were notoriously fragile because the filtration techniques were not very good. And the finos that we shipped to the United States from Osborne in the 1980s, they were always fortified to 17, 18, 19% alcohol. And this was done to protect the wine from saying that the yeast could reproduce inside the bottle. The floor yeasts, if they get in contact with the air, and if there's still traces of floor in the wine, they can actually reproduce inside the bottles, and I've seen that. So, in order to avoid that, they were always re-fortified. And then in the old days, all finos that were exported were of this type. The thing is, through the late 80s and 90s, all the companies moved away from these heavier finos and twice fortified finos into very, very light finos and manzanillas. And they can now, with modern filtration techniques, you can filter away any traces of yeast or bacteria. So you can actually sterilize the wine completely with biofiltration. So you could ship a wine at 15% or even less, and absolutely no problem. So we just wanted to have a wine that was like the sherries made in the past. And, I love this wine, and I'm a little bit surprised to see that so many people have actually found out about these wines and are showing them.
But the reason that you would do it a little bit higher in alcohol is because yours is not filtered.
Yes, and the thing is, if you do unfiltered wines and you don't re-fortify it, the shelf life will be very short, and there is a risk of re-fermentations and reproduction of the yeast inside the bottle. So we wanted to create a natural wine, but that could actually travel. This ancient way of doing things actually works. So it's a way of discovering the old, very special sherries, and you can actually also enjoy them not only very shortly after bottling, but you can enjoy it for a longer time.
And it's also single Solera.
Yes, yes. All the antique wines are single Solera wines, meaning that they come from one batch of barrels. There's a set of criaderas or nurseries that leads up to a Solera. And very often wines are a blend of many different wines. You know, you have an Oloroso, a brand of Oloroso, you might have, you know, 10 different Soleras going into the blend. Or Finos, you know, some of the big names in Fino will be a mix of a lot of different Finos from different cellars and so on. And these wines are from single Soleras. They are unblended, unsweetened, untreated, and bottled only once a year. And coinciding with the coolest part of the year, which is generally between December and early March, when temperatures in the cellars will be, well, say 8 to 10 degrees Celsius, which means that the wines are fairly settled and they're very clear in the casks. So we draw a certain amount from the casks. And again, only by taking the wine through a sort of paper filter to remove any larger solids, the wine is bottled. And on top of it, we've decided a long time ago that we wanted, you know, our wines to be for people that really know and love sherry. So we put them into clear glass so people can actually see, you know, when they see a bottle of antique Fino, they can see this sort of liquid gold color, which shows them that, you know, this is a wine which has been aged much longer than a normal Fino. You can see this, the dark topaz color of an Amontillado. You can see the mahogany color of an Oloroso. You can see the jet black color of the Pedro Ximénez. And you can also see the texture of the wines. You can actually turn the bottle around. The Pedro Ximénez is sort of very thick. It's almost like tar, you know. And you see the Amontillado, you can see that it's not been blended with sweet wines just because of the texture. So I think it's been a good thing. The thing is that these wines, since they're very natural, they will throw a deposit after a certain time. So, you know, after 2 or 3 years in the bottle, you'll see a sediment. So we put that on the labels, and we were concerned that, you know, some people might sort of start sending us the goods back or something, this wine is bad. But I haven't had a single bottle back.
But about your Fino Solera, one of the things that stood out for me in researching it is that the floor stays on that Solera year-round.
Yes, you know, we are located in the capital of the Sherry District, you know, Jerez de la Frontera, which is about 20 miles inland from the Atlantic Ocean, where Sanlúcar de Barrameda, the home of Manzanilla, and El Puerto de Santa María is located. You know, these coastal towns have a more humid, cooler climate, and Jerez has a drier climate. So, you know, we have to be careful, and we have to monitor the yeast very carefully because it's drier and hotter in the summer. So, first of all, we decided, you know, a long time ago that we would stay in the ancient old cellars. You know, our oldest cellars are from 1794, and what we call the new part was built in 1870. And they're sort of textbook bodega buildings, very thick outer walls, high roofs, good ventilation, floors that are made of something called albero, which is a type of sand, or which is compacted. And in summer, we would water these floors to create a better humidity in the cellars and also to reduce temperature. Because when water evaporates in the cellar, the evaporation takes energy from the surroundings that brings down the temperature. So what we decided very early on was that we would not do any summer bottlings of Fino or Manzanilla even, because we want to preserve the yeast in the best possible condition. So in summer, and also the coldest part of winter, when also the yeasts are a little bit more fragile, we would just keep the cellars closed, and we move in and water the floors in summer. And we do bottlings in autumn and in spring, and from say late June till late September we don't bottle anything, and in December, January, we don't bottle either.
And what about some of the other bottlings in the antique range?
Well, you know, the antique range, you know, the bottling, the ideal bottling time would be the coldest time of the year, when the wine is naturally clear in the casks. So, you know, with these wines, we bottle in that time. When we don't bottle Fino, we actually bottle the Amontillado, the Palo Cortado, the Oloroso, the Pedro Jimenez. And this system works well. And it's... We can do this because, you know, our volumes are not as large as the sort of the people that have to supply the big supermarket chains or whatever. You know, we release about less than 300,000 bottles a year, and so we can do this. But of course, it's very difficult if you make 30 ml bottles.
What is the age range of the different Soleras that you have for the antique range?
Well, you know, we were talking about the antique Fino, which is 8 to 9 years old, and then the Amontillado and the Oloroso has an average age of about 20 years, and then we have the two oldest wines are the Palo Cortado and the Pedro Jimenez, which have an average age of about 30 years. But, you know, that's the average. You know, these come from ancient Soleras, and some of these wines will actually contain traces of wines that are maybe 70 or 80 years old. And that's the beauty of the Solera system, that you're the fractional blending, and every single harvest that is included in the Solera system will actually enrich the final blend. And that's why I think... We should talk more about this, the fact that sherry has this unique feature of fractional blending in Solera systems, and it's a fantastic thing. I've compared vintage sherry and Solera sherry of similar age, and my conclusion is always that the Solera product is superior, and so I think it's something which is quite unique to sherry, and I think it's something we should talk more about.
Some of those wines that you have in the antique range would thus be possible to be labeled VORS, but you choose not to do that. Why is that?
Well, you know, I don't want to get in trouble with my friends at the Consejo Reglador, but you know, we looked at this, and as I said, you know, the Solera system effectively means that wines are a blend of a lot of vintages, and many, many bodegas will have wines that are made up of a lot of different vintages. So it makes it very difficult to verify outside, you know, which wine is 15 years old, 20 years old, 30 years old. And so I was against the use of the actual years on them, because it would be difficult to verify. Every single bodega, I can know the average age of my Solera, because I can just calculate, you know, how much I put in and I take out and how much I put in. So if I have, you know, 1,000 liters and I bottle 100 every year, it will be an average 10 years. But it's very difficult for outside sources, or outside control mechanisms to verify what your competition is doing. And I thought it was unnecessary, since a Solera means that in a wine that is 20 years old, you know, there will be wines that are significantly older, but also wines that are significantly younger. So it's also a sort of tricky thing where, you know, to sort of talk to the consumer about, you know, well, how do you sort of calculate this and everything. So I think we and a few of the other smaller producers, and also our partners at Equipo Navazos, La Bota, we also decided, you know, to, for the time being, you know, not using these claims. And it hasn't created any problems for us. And on the contrary, I think people now think of, you know, the VOS and VRS and the antique range from Fernando Castilla. Sort of, so we managed to create our own little category.
If I wanted to better understand the different styles of sherry that you produce and what the flavor differences would be and how they are produced differently across your range, what would you tell me?
Sherry is a very, you know, it's an ancient wine, and it's been produced for, well, as we know it today, I'd say practically 500 years. And over the time, there's developed a lot of different sherry, you know, official types of sherry. Everything from Manzanilla to Manzanilla Pasada to Palmas, Dos Palmas, Palo Cortado, Medium, Golden, you name it. There's a lot of different names. But actually, sherry can be grouped into three families of wines. The pale dry wines, which are the wines that are aged under floor. The what we call the biological aging means that the wine spends practically its whole life in the oak casks under a thick layer of floor yeasts. This is the largest family of wines and is produced by taking the original base wine, bringing it up to 15% alcohol, leaving it in oak casks that are filled up about 70%, and making sure that there's a certain amount of air circulation into the barrel that keep the yeasts alive. So that's one type. That's the most difficult wine to make. It needs sort of coolish, humid cellars, and it needs close monitoring of the floor yeast. And then the second style of wines will be the what we call the golden sherries or the brown sherries, the wines that are left unprotected by the yeast and left to oxidate in the barrels. And this is a different process. The type of barrels are the same, 500 liter casks filled up to about 70%, and also allowing a certain amount of air to enter the barrel. And the oxidation transforms a very neutral, pale, healthy base wine into something absolutely completely different. The oxidation slowly changes the color from almost like a greenish white color to golden color, amber color, mahogany color, and it goes darker and darker with time. And some of these wines actually, if we talk about Fino or Palo Cortado, they spend a certain amount of time under yeast, and then the yeast is removed by filtration, and then the wine is refortified a second time from 15% to 18%, and then left to oxidate in the barrels in a Solera or Amontillado, or if it's Palo Cortado, Palo Cortado. And then the third family of sherry would be, as I said, the pale dry wines are the white sherries, Fino Manzanilla. The brown ones, the main ones, are Amontillado and Oloroso. And then the very sweet sherries, main ones would be Moscatel and Pedro Jimenez, especially Pedro Jimenez. And these wines are, if we talk about Pedro Jimenez, it comes from wines that are grapes that are dried in the sun for anything between 4 and 10 days. The grapes will lose about 50% of their weight. So we calculate that from 100 kilos of grapes, we get 30 liters of must, grape must. And the grape must by law must have about 275 grams of residual sugar. Our base wines for Pedro Jimenez are normally around 300 grams of residual sugar. It's left to ferment for a short period. The actual alcohol from fermentation is normally between 1 and 2%. So when the actual fermentation starts, we will stall the fermentation by adding alcohol to the wine, up to 15% alcohol, and then move the wine into 500 liters casks and left to oxidate like other sherries. The thing is with Pedro Jimenez and also if it's Moscatel Pasa, it takes a long, long time for the wines to develop flavors, because they're so sweet that they're very stable. They're difficult to change. So you need a lot of time to make a very good Pedro Jimenez. It needs aging for a long time. It needs very good casks of very thick wood. So I talk a lot about this when people visit us, about sort of maturity levels with sherry. And it's like, sometimes I compare it to cheese. A great cheese is the one you get when it's at peak maturity. And this is different from different types of cheeses. But with sherry, I'd say, let's say Manzanilla. A Manzanilla from a good cellar can be perfectly enjoyable and fantastic when it's only about 3 years old. With Fino, we need a little bit more, especially Finos from Jerez, we need a little bit more time. Let's say 4 years like our classic Fino, it's a very, very fine wine already, with olorosos that are left to oxidate for directly when the wine is young. We can have a very good oloroso when it's about 6 years old. With Amontillado, we need more time, because to create a good Amontillado, you need to keep the wine on the floor for quite a long time. So say 4 to 5 years on the floor, and then it needs about the same time in the oxidative phase as the Oloroso. So you need another 6 years. So say 10 to 12 years. I don't know any good Amontillados, good young Amontillados. To me, it's like eating a cheese, and a Camembert cheese, just leaving the cheesery. It doesn't taste of anything. And to me, immature Amontillado is not a very nice drink. When it comes to, as I said, Pedro Jimenez and the Moscatel Passa, they need a lot of time, probably about 15 years.
Because one of the things I notice when I taste across your antique range is that the wines taste a little texturally thicker than their counterparts from other producers, a little bit perhaps more concentrated, and I wonder if that concentration is a result of more age in terms of your selections for release.
Well, I think our wines are, you know, in general, because, you know, you have to think, you know, the sherries that people encounter in general will be mostly the sherries from the very large producers that have very good distribution. Our style of sherry is sort of confined to the very, you know, the specialist wine shops and a lot of good restaurants. So they're difficult to find, and the wines from the larger producers, made in very large volumes, will normally be released younger. And as we were saying earlier, the antique sherries are all a lot older than most sherries. So the antique Fino is more than twice as old as a normal Fino. And our Pedro Jimenez antique is 30 years old, and there's a lot of Pedro Jimenez on the market, and 98% of it will be a lot younger. So that's why, you know, the concentration, it's not only a concentration with Pedro Jimenez, with the sugar levels and everything, all the wines concentrate, and they have more of everything. So that's why they, you know, when you have a glass of antique Amontillado, antique Oloroso, you could see that it sort of, it clings to the glass. The glass cries, as we say in Spanish, you know, that's the texture of the wine.
What should we say about how the grapes are sourced for most sherries in Jerez and your sherries in Jerez? Is there a difference in terms of where you're getting your grapes from some of the larger companies?
Well, you have to think, you know, sherry has originally been organized in a three-tier system, where there's been literally thousands of wine growers, and there's been hundreds of what we call almacenistas, which are private stockholders of wine that in the past tended to be sort of wealthy families that would invest in wine instead of putting the money in the bank. They would have private stockholdings of wine because it was a good way to beat inflation. And then there would be the shippers and the exporters that would be the people that would take these wines and blend them into the finished product, label it, and sell it in the export markets. This has been the system until, I'd say, 30, 40 years ago, when there's been more integration. There are companies that have vineyards. There are, a lot of the companies will have large stocks of wines themselves. So the role of the almacenista is almost disappeared. But what has not disappeared is the wine growing situation. At the moment, there are, I'd say, 25 relevant sherry producers left that we call shippers and exporters. And there's 2,800 wine growers, which means that, you know, on average, every sherry company has more than 100 suppliers of grapes. And, you know, some of the larger companies will have, you know, multiples of that. We have a partner in the business, which is a family that owns vineyards in Jerez. And we most of the wines that we use, well, all the Palomino that is used by Fernando de Castilla comes from from one source, which is our partner that owns a part of the business, and they have 43 hectares in the Pago Balbaina, which is one of the better areas of Albariza soil. And all the winemaking is done by hand. It's pressed in the vineyards by two pneumatic wine presses, which is unusual in Jerez. And the wine is fermented at the same facility in the middle of the vineyards. And also the first year of aging of the wines, what we call the sobre tabla, when the wine is sort of fortified and 60-70% of the crop is 45-15% and then left to age as fino, and about 30% to is aged as an oloroso. So all this takes place in one facility. So we can control, we have a clear idea of where our fruit comes from. The grower has a personal interest in getting the best possible product to us because they're a significant partner in the business. So for us, it's been a very good arrangement. And well, other producers, a lot of them will generally use base wines that come from cooperatives or you know, the sort of more standard sources. If you want to make a very high quality product, you have to try and add quality at all the different levels in the production process. And of course, you have to start with the vineyard. And I think there's too little talk about the vineyards in Jerez at the moment. We always talk, or most people talk too much about the cellars, the soleras, the all these things. And we have to go back, because I still remember 30 years ago, there was much, much more talk about the vineyards, the terroir. And in actually, good sherry has an expression of terroir as well as other good wines in the world. And wines coming from prime Albariza soil. Albariza, it's a Spanish word, and I think it needs explanation for most people, but it really comes from vineyards that are located on limestone, a very deep, chalky soil, which is almost white as snow, and has good porosity, so it retains humidity. From, you know, in Jerez it rains quite a lot in winter, but it doesn't rain at all in summer. So this capacity of the Albariza to retain humidity makes for much better wines than the ones that are planted on sandy soil or on the clay soils that we call barros.
You've collaborated at times with the project known as Equipo Navazos, a small release project of...
Yes. This is a project created by two very good friends of mine, you know, Jesus Barquin and Eduardo Ojeda. And, you know, I'm proud and I'm happy to be part of that since the very beginning. And it really started with Jesus and Eduardo coming to Jerez and you know, looking through the cellars and they quickly realized that you know, in very old soleras, like the ones that we find at Fernando de Castilla, you know, barrels tend to develop a little bit differently. So if you taste, you know, if you have 100 barrels in a solera, if you taste all 100 barrels, you know, suddenly you will have a cask which is you know, just better than the others. And the idea to select those casks and bottle that separately was a very good idea. And they've been primarily working in Jerez with us and with Valdespino, another very good producer. And they've been very good at selecting the wines and finding the right audience for the wine. So in Spain, you find those wines in the very best outlets, and same thing in the UK, in the US, and many other places. I think it's a very good concept, and it's also, you know, for us, it's helped us to, you know, be able to get sherry into areas that or the, you know, the very top end of the wine market where sherry had a, you know, difficult entry. The Equipo Navazos bottlings have really gained access in the sort of fine wine area of the wine market, and also when people turn the bottle around and they see who's made it, it's been good for us because we've had a lot of interest from, you know, journalists from the trade. Everybody say, well, if this very fine bottling from Equipo Athos is bottled by Fernando Castilla, well, Fernando Castilla must be making some pretty good stuff. So I think it's been a very mutually beneficial relationship, and it's continuing, and I think it's very good for the industry as such.
And you're known also for brandies, aside from the wine.
Yes, very much so. And this is my second, well, passion. And I'm not saying second because it's less important. I think some of the finest brandies in the world are found in Jerez. The brandy history in Jerez is as old as in the cognac industry. It started about 250 years ago, when Dutch merchants discovered that wine distillates aged in oak casks for a long time and sort of brought down to a drinking strength of about 40% was actually a very, very pleasant drink. And the drink was called brandewijn, which in Dutch, you know, it's difficult to pronounce in English. So it was, you know, this Dutch word was transformed into English brandy. And the Dutch started it in cognac, and they also started it in Jerez. And so there's been a strong brand industry in Jerez for a very long time. And it's today as important as the sherry industry. Many people don't realize this because a lot of the brandy stays in Spain. Whereas, you know, exports of sherry the export sherry is much higher. But for brandy, about 70% of the brandy produced stays in Spain. But still, it's an industry that turns out about 60 million bottles a year. And if you look at the top categories, you know, the reservas and grand reservas, there are some fantastic specimens. And I was lucky enough to take over the company with some fabulous brandies in the cellars. But also, most importantly, you know, the philosophy of how this brandy was made. Because it's not made like other brandies, not even in the region. First of all the distillates that we use are pot still alembic distillates from young, aromatic, unsulfured white wines that are distilled in small pot stills of 20 to 25 hectoliters with live log fire underneath. So we're actually using technology that goes back centuries. These wine distillates that we obtain, they generally come out at 62 to 65% alcohol. They're incredibly fragrant. And of course, when you make wine distillates at a very low alcoholic strength, you need perfect wines. So we carefully select the wines that are distilled. We get a very fruity, very fragrant, very aromatic wine distillate that we then season in new American oak casks for a certain period, or for the Grand Reserva brandies, we use Limousine French oak casks. And after a period in new casks, the brandies are brought out down to 42% alcohol and introduced into old sherry casks, and then aged for anything between 5 and up to over 40 years in sherry casks. And I think these three things, the use of exclusively the alembic, what we call Hollandas, or the alembic pot still distillates, the period in new oak, and the aging of the brandies in soleras at drinking strength as opposed to at full strength, like most producers do, makes for a very, very very natural brandy. We don't use any sugar, we don't use any color. So basically what you get is very fine wine distillates aged in very good casks, in very good cellars, the adequate amount of time. And returning again to sort of the idea of maturity, if you make grape distillates, brandy, it needs also, like sherry, it needs a certain maturity. And I think for brandy, the youngest age you can release a brandy to be sort of pleasant to drink for me is about 6 years. So that's why in the four categories of brandy produced in the area, we only produce brandies in the top two categories, the Reserva and the Grand Reserva. So it's like in cognac equivalent, we're only doing VSOP and XO qualities. We're not making anything below that. Simply because, you know, the type of distillates that we use are, they're very special, they're costly, they're scarce, and the process takes a long time. But again, we have a product which is clearly differentiated. Some people, again, you know, like our Amontillados and Palo Cortados, they're uncompromisingly dry, they're different, they're challenging to the uninitiated, but people that understand fine brandies, they immediately see that this is a fantastic product. And we also done some very fine bottlings with Equipo Navazos.
And you make a bit of vinegar.
Yeah. When I took over, we had a solera of about 40 barrels of sherry vinegar. And again, you know, sherry vinegar is an industry, and there's a lot of sherry vinegar made in the area. It's something like 10 million bottles produced of sherry vinegar. So it's also protected by denomination of origin. There's very few vinegars in the world with that consideration. But sherry vinegar initially was an accident. You know, it was a byproduct of the sherry industry. And sometimes the pheno casks would lose their floor. And when the wine at 15% alcohol is unprotected by the floor, air can get to the wine, and any wine has a certain amount of acetic bacteria. And sometimes, especially coinciding with high temperatures, the acetic bacteria would start to transform the alcohol into acetic acid, which is vinegar. And then this process would start, and then you would have to take that barrel out of the fino solera and put it into a solera vinegar. Well, that's what we call vino picado, or broken wine. So the origin of sherry vinegar was vino picado, you know, broken wines that were then left aside to develop into vinegar. And what people found out is that these vinegars that are, you know, the wines that are turned into vinegar just in barrels and just letting time transform the alcohol into acetic acid. This is a very slow process in a barrel. Well, we generally calculate that it takes 1 year for 1% of alcohol to turn into acetic acid. So if you the vino picado that you're starting with is 12-13% alcohol, well, that's the 12-13 years that you need for the process to be completed. So I took over a solera of 40 barrels of vinegar made this way. Slowly turning the wine into vinegar in barrels, just leaving them aside in a separate cellar. And my predecessor released the vinegar, and we've continued to make this vinegar. But there's also you know, the demand has outstripped the possible supply of this type of vinegar. So today, genuine vinegar made in, you know, accidental vinegars are very scarce, also because winemaking techniques have improved. So there's much less vino picado than there used to be. So today, most vinegar is actually made from Palomino-based wines that are blended with vinegar, what you call madre, so mother, the vinegar mother. So you blend young wine with vinegar, and then you put the wine into tanks where you blow oxygen through the wine, so you can speed up the process. You know, what takes 12 years in a solera, you can do it in 12 days. And then after that, you can take these vinegars and then age them for a period in oak casks to give them a little bit of that sort of sherry or oak character. And at the moment, we're actually making vinegar in both categories. We still continue to use the ancient solera of traditional sherry vinegar, but we only release about 3 barrels a year of that. This is what we call La Bodega. And the other traditional sherry vinegars, we make slightly larger volumes, but that's sort of more industrial type of vinegar. But there's a strong demand for sherry vinegar. especially in France, and it's also growing in the United States. And we actually sell our, we have an importer here in New York who sells our vinegars as well, and there's a lot of interest. It has to do with the general interest in food and everything. And sherry vinegar is, without any question, is the finest dry vinegar in the world. And it's fantastic with salad dressings, with gazpachos, with tomatoes, with seafood, with clams, with all sort of things. So it's an incredible ingredient.
Speaking about the general interest in food, and to swing back to the wines for a moment, do you find sherry pairing mostly with traditional Spanish food, or do you find it flexible with a number of different cuisines, or what has worked for you when you've tried to pair your own sherry with food?
Well, actually, you know, when this is one of my favorite topics, and you know, I had a group from the Wine and Spirit Education Trust visiting last week, and, you know, we were talking 2 hours in the cellars about sherry and sherry and food, because, you know, I always talk about the two together. And one of the guys told me, Jan, you know, I've never heard somebody talk so much about food in a wine cellar before. And, you know, it really helps us to understand, you know, what these products are for. And this is very much true with the type of sherry that we make. You know, they are all intended to be vinos de Jerez, you know, sherry wines. There are wines that has to be enjoyed with food. And idea of sherry only being something that you should pair with Spanish food, I think this notion we have to develop further. And I think sherry offers some incredible pairings with Japanese food. Things like sushi and sashimi is delicious with the younger finos and the manzanillas. With things like, you know, the soups and the more things where you have sauces and, you know, sweet soy sauces, miso, this type of thing, these flavors, and amontillados can be absolutely incredible. With meat dishes or duck or something like that, also in the Japanese or Chinese kitchen, olorosos can be incredible. So there's a lot of exciting pairings with Asian food. I would say I would single out Japanese and Chinese, you know, high-end Chinese food, but also, you know, moving from the obvious Spanish, the other fantastic combination. But there's also other kitchens, and I'd like, you know, because I'm Norwegian, but you know, the Nordic food is starting to get certain interest in that type of food as well, which is talking very much about the raw material, you know, fantastic food, seafood, fish, things from the forest, you know, like mushrooms and you know, vegetables and things like that. And there's some stunning combinations there as well. I think of, you know, things like the antique fino with hot smoked, you know, sort of fatty fish like mackerel or eel or trout or salmon. The field forest mushrooms with amontillado, you know, sort of any dish, you know, sort of game with mushrooms, sort of wintry dishes like that with amontillados and olorosos can be stunning. Not only, you know, possible combination, but actually incredible combination, offering something, a, you know, total experience, which sometimes is superior to what people, the wines that people normally do. So I would challenge people to try sherry more with that type of food. You know, when you have foods that are a little bit, you know, it's maybe difficult to pair with food, sherry should be on your radar. Say, well, you know, what do I serve with artichokes? You know, difficult with whites, difficult with reds. You know, why? Let's have a look at sherry. And sometimes sherry can be the answer. It can actually handle things that are sometimes difficult for other wines. And it's also, you know, in general, when you have many different flavors, you know, think of the Spanish tapas way of eating. You know, fino or manzanilla is a great tapas wine because you can serve it with, you know, fish-based tapas, with veg, you know, salads, things that you have a lot of vinegar. Sherry is a very low wine with very low acidity, so it matches dishes with vinegar or lemon dressings very well. It can also handle, you could have Fino with your albondigas, your meatballs, your chorizo, you know, meaty things as well, and it goes perfectly. And it's difficult to find another wine that can go so well with such a big variety of different things on the table.
You've followed the export markets for several years for sherry. Yes. Have you seen the consumer in the different markets change over that period? Do we see someone else drinking sherry today than we would have seen, say, 10 years ago?
I always talk about this because, you know, I see that, you know, we've managed to get, you know, the wine elite, you know, the most influential journalists, wine journalists in the world, the most influential sommeliers at the very best restaurants in the world, the masters of wine. You know, I very, very seldom, if ever, come across somebody who's really, really into wine that is not also a lover of sherry. So at the very top end of the market, you know, we've managed to conquer. And, you know, the sort of the lower end sherries have managed to create a big market at the very bottom end of the market. So, you know, the people that drink inexpensive supermarket owned labels in Holland or Britain, they don't know what they're drinking. They don't know that it's wine. They don't know where it comes from. If you ask them where they think it comes from, they probably say somewhere in southern England. And what the challenge for us now is to get to the type of consumer which are young people that are interested in wine, they're interested in food, they want to learn more. So these are people that are not necessarily sort of wine professionals, but they take their wine serious and they want to learn more, they want to be more interested, they want to know what they're drinking, where it comes from, who's the producer and all this. And I think that's where the volume can come from in the coming years, that when we get, you know, that type of consumer that, you know, thinks about what he's drinking, is not just buying any bottle from the off-license to have with his steak and potatoes, but he's actually thinking about what he's eating and what he wants to drink with it. So we see a growing recruitment to that sector, but I must say, you know, there are markets that are more receptive and markets that are more difficult. In terms of geographically, I see progress in Spain itself. I see progress in the UK a lot, especially in the London area. I see progress here in the United States, but primarily in sort of on the East Coast and in California. There are interest in Japan. You know, there's a growing market for sherry in Japan. And certain, you know, sort of embryonic tendencies in places like, you know, Scandinavia, Germany, Holland, and South America. Strangely enough, we're doing very well in especially in Brazil with sherry, and people don't. Well, my competitors are not paying much attention to Brazil because there's not a lot of sherry consumed in Brazil, but there's a fantastic moment in Brazil. The Brazilian Sommelier Association is the second biggest in the world after France. So there's something like 7,000 sommeliers in the country. There are fabulous restaurants with very good wine lists, and sherry is also entering sort of the market there. And the same thing in Mexico. Mexico is a fantastic food country, very limited wine consumption, but there's, you know, growing new generation of people that have maybe studied abroad, they've traveled, they learned about wine. So the wine consumed in Mexico is consumed by a certain portion of the consumers, but it's an interest, and we also see growth in that type of market. So there's a lot of interest, and even China. You know, we do things in China, and they're very receptive to our products as well. In places like Shanghai, Hong Kong, Russia, we do very, very well in Russia as well. So I think you know, if we work at it, and I tell my friends in the trade that, you know, because I've been out selling before coming to see you today. I've been out and about in New York and seeing customers. And when you talk to them and you show them wines, and and talk to them about, you know, how to use the products, they're interested. It's actually something which is not that difficult to sell, I think.
Jan Peterson of Bodega Fernando de Castilla, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Oh yes, it's Levy, and I've got some exciting, exciting news for you. 750 is now available in several more states. That's right, the amazingly powerful and easy-to-use 750 service and search tools are now available for wholesale buyers to use in Illinois, Massachusetts, Washington, D.C., Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, and South Carolina. That's in addition to all the states it's already been successful in, New York, New Jersey, California, Colorado, Connecticut, and Delaware. The 750 service is an amazingly powerful, simple-to-use, fundamental part of making your life as a wholesale buyer easier every day. Check it out, 750.com, for more information. That's 750.com. If you're a wholesale buyer in Boston, Chicago, D.C., anywhere in Virginia, check it out. 750 is there for you, ready to use. It's exciting. Get on it.
The big news for the podcast in 2014, retail partnership, my friend. The wines we care about from the folks who are on the show offered to you by the excellent team at Vine Wine. Go to vine-wine.com for more information about what we're up to and to find the wines. That's vine-wine.com. Check it out. Cheers.
And that's our show today. Thanks for listening. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and our own dedicated website, alldrinktothatpod.com. No apostrophe.